This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Most of us don't know much about workers' compensation until we need it. And your experience will depend a lot on where you live. Caps on benefits and higher bars to qualify as injured are a few of the changes made in most states beginning in the 1990s to lower the cost of workers' compensation. Employers and insurers convinced legislators and unions on both sides of the aisle that the costs were just too high. This is Angie Way of the California Labor Federation.
Now, the cost of health insurance and the cost of workers' comp kills our economy. Kills any growth potential for workers overall. And so until we can figure out how we control the cost of health care and workers' comp, it's going to constrain how much we can return to workers.
But guess what? Employers are paying the lowest rate for workers' comp in close to 40 years, leaving workers or taxpayers to pick up the tab when employees remain too disabled to return to work. Not since Teddy Roosevelt first called for a grand bargain between labor and management back in 1907 have injured workers received so little from employers convinced that they pay too much. So is Roosevelt's grand bargain still working today? Coming up, a look inside a big national investigation by NPR and ProPublica. And we'll ask the question, is workers' comp fraud really as widespread as some would have us believe? But first, joining us by phone is John Mastropietro. He's chairman of the State of Connecticut Workers' Compensation Commission. Mr. Mastropietro, thanks so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, who's eligible for workers' comp in our state?
Just about everyone, as long as they are not an independent contractor and they are considered an employee, meaning that they come under the control and direction of the employer, then they are eligible for workers' compensation benefits.
So who pays the cost for those benefits?
The employer traditionally does that in one of two ways. Either they purchase on the open market an insurance policy from one of the insurance carriers that writes workers' compensation insurance, or in the alternative with some employers, if they're the larger employers, they may choose to self-insure. And what that entails is an application to be submitted to the Workers' Comp Commission. We review that application for the financial viability of the employer and then make a determination as to whether or not that employer has the financial wherewithal to self-insure for its responsibilities. But those are the two primary ways that an employer meets its obligations under the law.
How have those costs changed over the years?
Well, the costs were extremely high in the 80s. Revisions took place to the law in the early 90s, 91, 93, and 95, with 93 being the overwhelming majority of the change that took place. As a result of that, the costs to an employer for insurance dropped dramatically as a result of those changes that have taken place. And those kind of stayed relatively static. In other words, the premiums remained in a relatively affordable vein for a considerable number of years. Unfortunately, over the past few years, we have seen somewhat of an increase, but the increase is almost exclusively related to medical costs. And of that medical cost aspect, that's almost exclusively related to the increase in prescriptive medication costs.
So medical costs are going up. Surprising that as much as medical costs have been rising, we've only seen the type of increase in workers' compensation costs to employers that we have. Well, why is that? It seems as though our health insurance goes up year after year after year because of these increased medical costs, not exactly on the same trajectory with these costs.
Well, you need to understand that when you're looking at the cost associated with a claim in its entirety, the medical is only a portion of the claim. The indemnity is the other portion. And when you are in the kinds of economic times that we have been in most recently, you're dealing with a situation where there have been pretty much static salaries. Salaries have not increased tremendously. Most of the workers' comp indemnity portion is based upon the average weekly wage that a person earns. And so you're dealing with a situation with static wages, and you're dealing with lesser numbers of employees, which makes the new employees coming in generally being paid at a lesser rate than someone who may have been working there for, say, 20 years. So you're looking at the indemnity portion being at least static, if not coming down a little. Then add that to the medical, and you're seeing that the overall increase that an employer faces is not that dramatic. Hopefully, however, the economy will continue to improve to the point where you're going to have wage increases. And at that point, there may be some indemnity increases, which is the reason we want to get our arms around the medical aspect now so that it doesn't become too great a burden when the economy begins to thrive, as we all hope it will, in the near future.
In a moment, maybe we'll find out a little bit more about how you plan to get your arms around this. We're talking with John Mastropietro, who's chairman of the State of Connecticut Workers' Compensation Commission. We're learning how workers' comp works today on the program in Connecticut and nationwide. In a little bit, we're going to be talking with two reporters for ProPublica and NPR who've done a big national report on how workers' compensation has changed, and not for the better, for workers in many parts of the country. Connecticut doing relatively well. Next question for you, John. Who decides if a worker is disabled and entitled to benefits in Connecticut?
Well, the ultimate decision maker, if there is a contest, is going to be the commission. There are 15 trial commissioners, and any disputed matter is brought before the commission. The commission is adjudicatory in nature, and so a claim has been filed, a dispute arises, it goes before the commissioner, and the commissioner makes that determination. But those are only for the disputed claims, and the disputed claims are significantly less than the total number of claims that are filed. If you're dealing with a situation where the person gets hurt, the injury occurs in front of five co-employees so that there is clearly a witnessed event, the employer does what it is supposed to do, and that is to file a first report of injury and notify the insurance company. The insurance company talks with the employer and says, is there any reason why we need to contest this? Is there anything to dispute, anything of concern? And the employer says, no, it happened, and five co-employees verified that it occurred. At that point, the insurance company should be calling the employee and making arrangements for the injured worker to receive, first of all, the medical treatment that he or she needs, and then everything else falls into place. So the answer to your question is it could be the employer, it could be the insurer, and that's the way it happens in most of the cases when it is a claim that has not been disputed. But in those instances in which it is disputed, then the commissioner will end up making the decision after evidence is presented to he or she.
How does the recommendation of a personal physician or a doctor or a surgeon, how does this play in?
When it goes into the commission and it falls before a commissioner acts just like any administrative law judge would act, and so their decision is based upon evidence. And the doctor's reports become the evidence upon which the commissioner makes the decision.
There are four levels of reimbursement, if I understand correctly, in Connecticut. Can you run through what those are?
The first level reimbursement is known as temporary total disability, and that's generally the benefit that's given to an individual when they cannot perform any meaningful work whatsoever. Simplest example is this person who is injured and needs surgery. For the time period shortly after the surgery, they're totally incapacitated. They're entitled to total disability as a result of that time period. After that, if the person progresses to the point where physically they can now perform something, but that something is not their former job. In other words, they have some physical capacity, but not enough to perform the job that they were injured at, then they are eligible to receive what's known as temporary partial benefits. And those temporary partial would either be as part of a return to work in a light duty capacity, or it could be a variety of different ways. But it's a recognition that the person is no longer totally disabled, but yet cannot go back and do the job that they did before. That benefit would continue up until the time that the person is determined to have reached maximum medical improvement. And when they reach maximum medical improvement, which is basically the doctor saying that's all that we have to offer, it may not be that the person is 100% returned to the same status as before, but it is the doctor saying this is what medical science has to offer and we have nothing more, then the person receives what's known as permanent partial disability, and that is not a wage replacement. That is a loss of use of a body part replacement benefit. It is statutorily governed. Each body part that for which a reimbursement is allowed has a specific number of weeks associated with it. So, as an example, if you injure your master arm and were to have 100% loss of use of the master arm, you would be entitled to 208 weeks of benefits under our statutory scheme. If, however, after your injury, the doctor comes back and says, well, you have a 10% permanent loss of use. So in other words, 90% of your arm you could still, but 10% is a permanent loss. Then you would get 10% of the 208, or you would get 20.8 weeks of benefits. Those are not wage replacement. So you could have already returned to work, be receiving your salary, and still receive this above and beyond your salary because it is a reimbursement for loss of use of a body part.
Okay.
And then the fourth category is a discretionary category, and that is after you have received all of your permanent partial benefits, if you are still unemployed, still having difficulty finding employment, you may receive an additional benefit not to exceed the number of weeks that you received as a permanent partial impairment. So in our example, it would be that the person would be eligible for another 20.8 weeks of benefits at the discretion of the commissioner should the person demonstrate that he or she is making a bona fide effort to try to find work and simply has been unsuccessful in doing that.
When we come back from our break in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking more about some of the issues regarding the loss of use of an arm or a leg, how it varies from state to state. Connecticut actually does quite a bit better than the national average. Got a few more questions for you, John. Before we take that break, though, you mentioned 1993 and some laws that changed. Specifically say what happened in Connecticut law that did shift things for workers.
In 1993, the greatest impact on workers directly was that the statutory benefit scheme was in effect reduced by one third across the board. So whereas master arm prior to 1993 would have had an eligibility of 312 weeks, it now has an eligibility of 208 weeks. And each one of the body parts that are listed within the statutory scheme in Connecticut was reduced by one third. That was the direct impact on employees that employees would feel directly. There were several other changes that were administrative in nature, operational, and yes, the employee would also feel the effects of that in terms of timetables to get to trial and those kinds of things. But the direct payment aspect that they would have most directly felt would have been that one-third reduction in the statutory scheme.
And a last thing for you. In 2014, the state adopted a medical fee schedule that caps payments to hospitals and other medical facilities. This is one of the changes in the law that essentially seems to suggest that Connecticut is, although it does much better as far as workers' compensation benefits than most other states, it has moved slightly in a different direction. What can you tell us about that legal change last year?
That legal change was was the result of an archaic law that existed on the books of the state of Connecticut from 1921 that simply did not work any longer in today's environment. And it has been one of those ticking time bombs that was ready to go off. And last year, the decision was made to bite the bullet, determine exactly how we were going to deal with the long-term aspects of a law that no longer fit. And the best way that the legislature determined that can happen was to formulate a fee schedule for both the hospitals and for surgical clinics. And they charged the compensation commission with the obligation of putting that together. And we did that, and it went into effect, took effect April 1st of this year.
There are two bills in the state legislature right now that would make it easier for firefighters who have certain cancers and police officers with PTSD to get workers' comp benefits. Very quickly, John, can you just explain what you understand about these potential bills and how they would actually change the laws that are on the books right now. An awful lot of what we're talking about is use of a limb. We're not talking about things like post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, with respect to the firefighters portion of that bill, there were two bills. They actually have been collapsed into one bill now. The firefighters portion of that bill, technically, as we sit here today, all of those things are already covered. In other words, if a firefighter were able to prove that the cancer that he or she contracted was as a result of work, they would be eligible for benefits under today's law. What this new provision does, if it were to pass, is to change it so that the firefighter receives a presumption that it occurred. So it's no longer the obligation, it would no longer be the obligation of the firefighter to prove that the cancer is as a result of work. It would now switch to the employer to prove that the cancer was not the result of work. So it creates a rebuttable presumption and makes it easier for the firefighter to be able to prove that case because there's a presumption going in. With respect to the police officer and the PTSD, right now what exists on the law is that the police officer who experiences PTSD as a result of the kind of horrific sorts of things that that bill talks about is still eligible for psychological treatment, but is not eligible for any other aspect of workers' comp. In other words, is not eligible for benefits if they are out of work. The officer would now have to use their own sick time or vacation time or whatever it is that their collective bargaining agreement allows them to use. This law, if it goes into effect, would not only extend the medical treatment that presently exists, but would also give them benefits for periods of time that the doctors believe that the person needs to stay out of work in order to truly recuperate.
And we'll be watching that legislation as we near the end of this legislative session. Thanks to John Mastropietro, who's chairman of the State Workers' Compensation Commission. Thank you for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
After our break, we're going to talk about a big national investigation by NPR and ProPublica into the changing world of workers' compensation. That's next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Since 2003, 33 states have reduced the amount of benefits workers are entitled to receive if they're injured on the job. As we're learning today, our benefits in Connecticut are generous compared to other states who are stopping benefits before workers are well enough to get back to work, some who can never return to work at all. Employers say the cost is just too high, even as they pay the lowest rates in decades, leaving taxpayers to pick up the bill. Joining us are two men who did an extensive report for NPR and ProPublica on this issue. Howard Berkus is a correspondent with NPR's Investigations Unit. Welcome back to our show, Howard.
Good to be back with you. Thanks.
And Michael Grable is a reporter with ProPublica. He's based in New York. Michael, thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So we talked a little bit earlier about Connecticut, Howard, and how some of our laws changed around 1993. That's a big mark for a lot of the changes that you and Michael have been tracking. Tell us what's really happened around the country since the mid-1990s with workers' comp.
Well, ProPublica, Michael did this analysis of workers' comp changes since 2003 and found that in 33 states, either benefits have been reduced, it's been more difficult to qualify for benefits, or there were new limits on the extent of the time period that medical benefits were provided. The importance of this investigation and John Mastropietro's look at the 1993 changes that we just heard about in Connecticut, what's important about all this is that these kinds of changes are largely off the radar, certainly on a national level, and that the impacts on workers when these changes take place either aren't considered or aren't given a lot of attention. And that's what we have been trying to do, is what's the impact on workers? How are they affected when these benefits changes occur, when it's more difficult for them to get benefits? And that's what I think has stirred up the workers' comp world as we've taken a look at this. we've been looking at it from the perspective of workers and what happens to them and how difficult it is for them to continue to just pay their bills or to get the medical care that they need or to lose the benefits that they had as these changes take place.
So, Michael, what's the reason given for some of these changes? We're going to get to some of the real impacts that you've reported on with Howard on the workers around the country, but why have these changes started in the 1990s and, as you've reported, really taken hold since the early 2000s?
Well, there's a number of different reasons. I mean, if you start back in the 1990s, when Connecticut was looking at its changes, across the country there were rises in insurance rates, and this was considered a crisis. The period that we looked at that occurred in the early 2000s, with the exception of California, nobody was really seeing tremendous increases in their workers' comp rates. There were slight increases. There were some increases in medical, as all of the healthcare industry has been dealing with. So those were things that were cited, the rise in medical costs. But by and large, the thing that we heard over and over again when we did our reporting across the country was, why is our state so expensive compared to the state next to us or the state to the south of us or the east? And there's this sort of drive of competition of, if we don't reduce our workers' comp rates, then that business is going to go to the next state, or businesses are threatening to leave because they can get a cheaper rate in the state next to us. And this has largely been driven by the two recessions we had almost back-to-back in the early 2000s, and then with the recent Great Recession, 2007-2009, combined with the 20-year decrease in manufacturing we've seen across the country, these high-paying middle-class jobs. And so workers' comp, or reducing workers' comp, is becoming a economic development tool, which it was never designed to be. It was really designed to be kind of a benefit system in replace of lawsuits. If we take a step back real quickly, workers, if you get hurt on the job, you cannot sue your employer. You are limited to this level of benefits, and this is sort of the system that you play in. And so that's why it's kind of alarming, I think, seeing employers step back and step back these benefits or qualifications that workers, the ability that workers to qualify for these benefits.
This kind of race to the bottom that we're talking about, where states are competing with each other to try to lower workers' compensation costs, this has played out in these stories that you told on NPR, Howard. Maybe you can remind our listeners who heard, or for the first time tell our listeners who didn't hear, the stories of Jeremy Lewis and Josh Potter. These are two men from different states nearby who both lost part of their left arm, essentially the same injury, but what happened to them afterward was wildly different.
Yeah, it's a great example of because workers' comp is basically a state function. The states decide what the benefits are going to be and what the restrictions are on benefits. And so in Alabama, you have Jeremy Lewis, who lost a portion of his arm in a chicken feed plant and ended up with his lifetime benefit for losing that arm would have been about $45,000-$48,000. Just across the border in Georgia, Josh Potter, who lost a portion of his arm in a plant that manufactures soundproofing material for cars, his possible lifetime benefit is almost $700,000 more. There are complicated formulas involved in all of this, but basically the bottom line is that lawmakers in Alabama set, benefits at a certain level. And by the way, the weekly pay for Jeremy Lewis, which is a wage replacement benefit, is $220 a week, which, was set in 1985, that rate, and hasn't changed since, and is basically relegating him, would relegate him to a life of poverty. The benefits vary dramatically between states because state lawmakers have different views of what workers should get. In many states, lawmakers don't want to give too much money because they want to give workers an incentive to go back to work. Losing an arm doesn't prohibit somebody from going back to work. So you have these dramatic differences. And it's also what we found, which relates to Jeremy Lewis and Josh Potter in another way, is that they both received both a myoelectric prosthesis, which kind of looks like a real arm, and it moves like the hand on it moves like a hand. It's very high tech sort of thing. Plus, they got a mechanical arm that has a hook on the end of it. But in North Dakota, a guy named Dennis Wedby, whose arm was blown off in an oil rig explosion, was only given the mechanical arm with the hook. And so here you have two states which have, you know, don't have the greatest benefits, or known for being somewhat stingy on benefits. The workers can get both the mechanical arm and the electric arm. But in North Dakota, Dennis Wedby can only get the mechanical arm. The state refused to give him the electric arm. And as he says, I lost, you know, an arm. I didn't lose a hook. That's another disparity in these benefits from state to state. So based on sort of where you're born or where you're injured could determine how whole you're made in response to your workplace injury.
We're talking about workers' compensation on the program today. Let's go to Danny, who's calling from New Haven. Hi there, Danny. You're on Where We Live.
How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
So I work as a researcher for the Carpenters Union, and one of the things that we see many times that pertains to workers' compensation is out-of-state contractors will come in, perform work on a construction site, and not get the requisite workers' compensation. And should someone fall and get hurt or injure themselves at the job, if that workers' compensation is not in place, that certainly has an implication for the worker. However, if they go to a hospital, they don't have insurance, et cetera, that compensation is not in place. It also has an impact on our local economy and our local revenue streams. And we see this here in Connecticut as the snow melts, folks are starting to work again. I just wanted to highlight that fact.
Oh, Danny, thank you very much. Michael, one of the things that he brings up and that Howard was just talking about, too, is often workers are encouraged to go back to work after being injured. Sometimes that's something that they can do when they get back. They are at the type of job where a serious injury may allow them to do some work. In other cases, it cuts down on productivity. It cuts down on their earning potential. It seems as though sending back workers who aren't well enough to work is both a systemic problem and also something that hurts the economy long term.
Yeah, one of the things that we've seen across the country is the rise of outside medical examiners. These are, you know, not the doctor that you're treating with, but the insurance company or someone else within the state can send a worker to someone for a quick exam, sometimes just someone who's going to review their medical records. And many states have given those outside medical reviewers the power to overrule the doctor that a worker has been treating with for months, sometimes years, and say they're ready to go back to work. They're not. This wasn't work-related at all, and they're not entitled to any benefits whatsoever, or that they're not as disabled as their doctor says. And this has created, not just an individual hardship for those workers, but something that affects all of us as taxpayers. What happens when these workers get denied benefits and still have needs is that they then apply for Social Security disability insurance, which is paid through federal tax dollars. They apply for food stamps. They apply for Medicare. And so these costs get shifted back away from the employer who may have, in a lot of these cases, been responsible for those injuries and get shifted to the taxpayers.
Well, let's actually listen to a bit of one of Howard Berkus's stories on this issue. Here's Joel Ramirez, 48-year-old, in need of workers' comp since the 2009 accident left him paralyzed below the waist. Upon a review of his case, he was denied 24-hour health aids initially approved to help him.
There was my mom here, but she's 75 years old. Oh, my God, I was trying to clean up. My God, I couldn't finish cleaning. And I said, I can't even do it right now. How am I going to do it when I get older? Those moments is when makes you think to die before that happens.
And Howard, that story is one that illustrates what we were just talking about.
Jill Ramirez needs 24-hour home health care. His insurance company agreed to that. And then the law was changed in California, sweeping reforms in the state of California for workers' compensation. And the insurance company used the new law to reopen his case. There was a request for a medical treatment by his doctor, had nothing to do with his home health care, but the insurance company, in reviewing that, took away the home health care, and he was left to basically sit in his own feces for hours on end at times because he didn't have the home health aide who was there to help him keep clean. That's what he was talking about. This situation in California is an example again of what Michael was just talking about, in which these cases are being sent to medical reviewers who are ruling in favor of insurance companies. In the case of California, when these cases go to what's called independent medical review, go all the way through the system, the insurance companies get decisions that are favorable to them more than 90% of the time. And in Joel Ramirez's case, it took him months and months and months to get this sort of sorted out. And in the meantime, he's struggling. His wife quits her job so that she can be home with him. His daughter drops out of school and takes a job so she can help make money for the family, so the family can get by. The insurance company makes a decision that has these enormous impacts on somebody like Joel Ramirez. And in fact, a couple of responses in California, the state of California has launched an audit of the insurance company involved in that decision. There is legislation pending that would prohibit insurance companies from revisiting a case like his in which the treatment plan had been agreed to.
Mm. Another story that you report on, John Coffle, he lost his home, split up his family of five when a new law in Oklahoma reduced the temporary support checks he got after injuring his back at a tire plant last year. This is his wife, Justine, speaking.
As soon as he got hurt, it was like we went from being in the house with the kids and being a happy family to everything just falling apart in one swift motion. I mean, it really felt like somebody just shook everything in our lives and scattered it all over the place.
And Michael, this has to do with the somewhat controversial and the complicated, problematic partial permanent disability. What can you tell us about John Coffle's story?
Yeah, well, John's story is more to do with the wage replacement benefits in Oklahoma. It used to be that you could, so essentially you get paid a portion of your wages. In Oklahoma, it was 70% of your wages. And then they have a maximum cap that they put on it. And for many years in Oklahoma, you could get up to the state average weekly wage, 100% of the state average weekly wage, which was $800 or so. When they reformed the system 2 years ago, they changed that to 70% of the state average wage. So all of a sudden, these high-paid factory workers like John, who worked at a Goodyear tire plant, one of the best jobs around in his area, is now limited to $561 a week and has to get by on that. So he sees a dramatic decrease in his wages as he's recovering from his injury. And just to sort of stop right here, this wasn't an out of the ordinary injury. This was a guy who had a bulging disc in his back that occurred when he was pushing a heavy load of rubber at work, and it took a few months for him to get the surgery and to get back on his feet. But in the meantime, he's lost his utilities get cut off, he loses his cars get repossessed. He loses his home that they were renting to get evicted. All of a sudden, their life is thrown, as Justine said, just sort of thrown into pieces. They send the kids to go live with grandparents. They don't have enough money to see them except on weekends where they can afford the gas. And this literally rips the family apart. This was a system that's designed to protect workers from falling into these financial calamities just because they got hurt at work. And so now John is having to turn, the family had to turn to food stamps to cover the gap. John is trying to get back to work. I think there's some issues with trying to get back at Goodyear. He's even turned to GoFundMe, this online fundraising thing where he's asked the public for anything that they can offer so that he can reunite with his family. So this is a result of a change where the legislature thought, hey, we'll do this. We'll become more competitive with Arkansas, And what they didn't realize, or no one really thought to bring up, was that they are now the third lowest, you know, in terms of this cap on benefits, they are now the third lowest in the country. They're not the middle of the pack. They're even lower than Arkansas in terms of compensating workers at these factories that they're trying to attract in the state.
We're talking with Michael Grable, who's a reporter with ProPublica, and Howard Berkus, who's a correspondent with NPR's Investigations Unit. They co-reported a series on workers' compensation that you can see more of on WNPR.org/where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, WNPR's Diane Orson guest hosts a program about college behind bars. We'll meet a man convicted of a bank robbery who earned his bachelor's and master's degrees while in prison. He's now a student at Yale Divinity School. We'll also hear about the power of a liberal arts education to prepare people returning from prison life to life on the outside. That's coming up on the next Where We Live. Today, we're revisiting a program about changes in workers' compensation laws in the last decade that have left too many workers injured on the job falling through the cracks, leaving families and taxpayers to pay the bills. So does this pact between employers and workers still work? Are employers and employees getting what they agreed to way back in the early 1900s? What do you think? You can tweet us at Where We Live. We're joined by Howard Berkus. He's a correspondent with NPR's Investigations Unit, who joins us from his office in Utah. Michael Grable is a reporter from ProPublica, who joins us from NPR in New York. Let's go to Kevin, who's calling in from Enfield. Hi, Kevin. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind, Kev?
Hey, I've been dealing with the workman's comp for about 9 years now. And it used to be set up for the employee. Now the workman's comp is not set up for the employee anymore. It's set up for the employer and the insurance company. And until you rehab the workman's comp, nothing's going to get done. I've been dealing with this, like I said, for 9 years. I go in front of the workman's comp commissioner. He orders the insurance company to do something. They don't do it until we have to go back into court and see him again. It's a travesty that workman's comp, what it was set up for, is not what it's doing now.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for sharing the story. I want to put that to Michael Grable. I mean, we see through your reporting that, comparatively speaking, a place like Connecticut does a much better job as far as providing benefits at a higher rate than most of the rest of the country. But that doesn't mean there aren't still some problems. Are the things that you hear Kevin saying, the things that you hear all around the country, not just in some of these troublesome spots, places like Oklahoma or Alabama?
Yeah, there's an immense frustration among injured workers, we find, in trying to get the benefits that they're entitled to. Sometimes in states like Connecticut, Washington, where they're fairly, they've remained fairly high compared to other states that have cut so drastically. Even though this was a system that was meant to limit litigation, what has happened is in a lot of states, it really hasn't done that. It's sort of just replaced it with a different system of litigation within these administrative courts. One of the things that we also hear, so one of the things that we found in some of these states is that there's really no constituency for the future injured worker. They come in and they, businesses and insurance companies often cheerlead these changes as necessary. And the only one that you can that you hear from are sometimes unions, trial lawyers. You hear from people who got hurt in the past, and they say, well, we won't cut those benefits. So there's no one who's going to stand up and say, hey, I might get hurt in the future, because I don't expect to get hurt in the future. The other thing that we find is that, you know, in states that are fairly well, is You know, I'm blanking on what I was about to say, so I'm just going to cut myself short and let you go to the next question.
Well, and then that next question, actually, I'll put to Howard. This whole idea of states competing, we were shocked to see in your reporting that neighboring New York State does not provide benefits at the same level of Connecticut. Howard, we look at our states and say we're trying to be competitive on tax policy, we're trying to be competitive in economic policy, but here's one where it seems as though New York and Connecticut have approached things very, very differently. And in the Northeast, overall, workman's compensation is taken somewhat more seriously by states, but not across the board.
Well, we do find in many states that there are – this is a concerted effort in some states where there are business groups, often large companies like Walmart and Hobby Lobby, that are – pushing these changes in workers' compensation because of this competitiveness between states. But it also has happened in states. And they look for, and they're very open about this, they look for states that have recently become predominantly Republican in their legislatures or in the state house or both. And that's where, you know, that's who is targeted for these changes. But it's not just Republican states where changes are being made. California has a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature and has had one of the largest reforms of workers' compensation that any state has had. And they're now finding problems with that reform effort. And New York is another example of that. It's this pressure to compete between states is really enormous. And as Michael said, you know, the recessions help push states to sort of try to figure out how can we attract business and how can we hold on to business. In Oklahoma, there were companies that were telling lawmakers, we're going to move across the state line to Arkansas because their workers' comp costs are lower, and that's such a big cost for us. We want to, you know, we're going to do that, and so there's, you know, that competition is really intense. One other really important thing here is that Michael did something that was very interesting. He took a 1972 federal study of workers' compensation and recommendations by a workers' compensation commission. This was a Nixon administration commission headed by a Republican that made recommendations for minimum sort of standards that states should meet with their workers' comp benefits. And that was used as the benchmark for what we're looking at. What has happened with those minimum standards, which most states embraced at the time, but then slowly fell away from. And one of the recommendations at the time of that commission was, if the states don't meet these standards, Congress should step in and force them to do that. Now, that hasn't happened. There has been no federal role to kind of referee between states as they're making these changes. The Labor Department used to track these changes until, what was it, Michael, 2006? 2004, and then the funding was cut for that. And so even the Labor Department, the Federal Labor Department, is no longer monitoring compliance with these commission recommendations. So it's kind of a free-for-all, really, where you have each state responding to whatever kinds of pressures are being applied by big business in those states, by chambers of commerce. What we see is not much consideration for what happens to workers like John Coffell and others who we've profiled making these changes. And when we go back to them after in Oklahoma, we went back to them and we said, look what's happening here with this worker. You know, the response we got was, well, you know, we didn't anticipate that. If that happens to a lot of people, we'll make changes. Mm. It's a system in which workers don't seem to be considered. And the grand bargain that you mentioned in your introduction, which is workers can't sue their employers in exchange for getting these benefits. In many states, people who are advocates for workers say that grand bargain is now broken and that needs to be revisited given these changes in workers' compensation.
Well, Michael, as we run low on time, though, I want to read something from the flip side here. Douglas emails us. He says, I'm a small employer in Connecticut. I believe in the idea of workman's comp. I feel it's important to create a safe workplace. But at what point should an employee bear some responsibility for their actions? I'll just roll that in with a question that I have that a lot of people ask is, what about fraud? I mean, how much fraud is in the system? Because that's something that a lot of lawmakers certainly talk about wanting to guard against.
Right. So workers' comp is a no-fault system. It's designed where we're not going to fight over who caused the accident. Was it the employer not having a guard on the machine? Was it the employee who wasn't paying as much attention as he should have been? So with the exception of a few things like drugs and alcohol, most states have kept that in place where, since you can't sue, this is a benefit system where if you get hurt, we're not going to ask how it happened. It's just... it's something that's it's work-related and it's going to be compensated. Fraud is a very small part of the $60 billion in costs that go out every year in workers' comp benefits. We found, looking at some of these studies, that when you look at who the amount of money that's lost to fraud, it often happens that it's on the employer or the medical provider that's causing these large things, even though we might see on TV these surveillance camera shows that seem very sexy, for lack of a better word. They really, when it comes down to numbers, it's what one of your other callers was talking about is coming into a project and saying that all of your workers are independent contractors, and these people are on their own for their safety, and I'm not directing what they're doing. They are completely self-employed. Those people are not protected on the job, and that is a fraud to the insurance company and to the employers, like the one who you just spoke to, because they are essentially taking money out of the system but not paying into it for these dangerous construction-type jobs. The other thing I wanted to get to, I think Kevin had asked about sort of the frustrations in the system that seems to be functioning well in terms of the law. One of the things that we heard over and over again is that even though insurance company executives might have these high minds, sometimes high-minded messages, sometimes this isn't passed down to the claims adjuster, who's just told to reduce costs and control costs as much as possible. Sometimes the claims adjuster might go into this with this great mindset of, I'm doing this job because I'm actually helping people. But the mandate from the insurance company is to reduce costs. So they've got these conflicting messages of how they're supposed to handle a claim. Now, at the same time, in the last 20 years, there's been an increase in third-party firms that are being brought in to sometimes administrate the claim separate from the employer and the employee who should be working this out. There are people who help people find doctors to put in their plans, and people who find these outside medical reviewers to look at paperwork. And so there sometimes can be several steps away between the employer and the employee and getting that employee back to work, where the communication breaks down and all of these different third-party firms are taking a fee on their services and taking money out of the system that could be paid for benefits or could be paid to for lowering the employer's cost.
A series of reports from ProPublica and NPR's Investigations Unit are available online. You can go to WNPR.org/where we live for links to these stories told by Michael Grable, who's from ProPublica, who joined us today from NPR in New York. Michael, thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Howard Berkus. He's a correspondent with NPR's Investigations Unit. Howard, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate your interest.
Our program today was produced by Betsy Kaplan with help from Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.